Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Affordable Care Act was signed into law by President Barack Obama on March 23, 2010. It's also known as Obamacare. It is a landmark federal law that was the most significant expansion of health care in America since the creation of Medicaid, Medicare in 1965. And here's what happened when then Vice President Biden joined the bill's signing celebration.
America becomes a whole lot wealthier because tens of millions of Americans will be a whole lot healthier from this moment on. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States of America, Barack Obama.
Thank you, everybody.
Well, it was a hot mic moment for Vice President Biden at the time. He whispered into President Obama's ear, not quite so whisper, but it was pretty loud. Mike picked it up saying it was a big fracking deal, but he didn't say fracking. So was it really a big bleeping deal? Is it still a big bleeping deal? How did America end up with Obamacare? What lessons can we learn from that political struggle? Have you been impacted by Obamacare for good or for ill? Let us know. The number is 833-877-8255-833-TPR-TALK. Send us an email to thesource@tpr.org. And you can text us at the call-in number 833-877-8255. Tell us, do you remember those protests against it, for it? Were you part of those protests? How did that work out for you? So our guests right now, we're joined by Philip Rocco, PhD, co-author of Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act. And Philip Rocco, welcome to The Source.
Great to be here, David.
So President Biden saying it was a big bleeping deal. Was it? Is it?
Yeah, I think if you look at just in terms of the percentage of Americans who lacked health insurance in 2009, before the law passed, it was about 18% of Americans lacked any health insurance at all. Today, that number, that percentage is around 8% of Americans who lack health insurance. And if you look at the effects of coverage expansion, right, if you think about the law is not necessarily something that's perfect, there's still a lot of gaps, still a lot of people out there paying way too much for health insurance. But the expansion itself did have effects, right? Multiple studies have shown that people who got coverage expansion through the Medicaid expansion, if their states did that, they are now more likely to get early enough cancer diagnosis. Early stage diagnosis rates have gone up. Smoking cessation has gone up. Behavioral health outcomes have increased in states that have expanded Medicaid. And even the states that expanded Medicaid, the mortality rate among adults who are in the expansion population went down. So I think, while it is certainly the case that the United States is an outlier among developed countries in terms of the poor quality, limited access, and high cost of its health care, at least relative to the U.S. baseline, there were measurable changes as a result of the Affordable Care Act. But nevertheless, I think one of the other big kind of impacts is it is something that the sort of the partisan division over the law really shaped politics in the healthcare domain for the decade since the law passed. So I think that's an important effect as well.
We should absolutely note that Texas is a state that has yet to expand Medicaid, and it has there's no indication that that's going to change under the Republican regime that controls Texas right now. And so what has Texas missed out on by not expanding Medicaid?
So right now, if Texas were to expand its Medicaid program, which would mean this, it would mean that the Affordable Care Act allowed states, well, initially it required them to expand Medicaid, then the Supreme Court gutted that requirement. States still have the option, and for a very generous sum, states pay almost nothing to do this. Federal government picks up 90% of the tab. Texas would be able to expand Medicaid coverage to about 1.4 million adults. That's 34% of the state's uninsured non-elderly adult population. So that's a pretty big impact just in terms of people's ability to get health care. But then the other thing to consider is that when you pass a law or when you expand Medicaid, because of the role of health care in our economy, expanding Medicaid also has a huge economic multiplier effect. States' economic growth expands. Rural hospitals gain financial stability and are less likely to fail. And rural hospitals, as you know, are not just lifelines for patients. They're also significant providers of jobs in rural areas. And they need a lot of services, so they provide economic interactions in the form of contracts with other providers in the area. So on net, it is an economic boon, especially for areas that are economically hurting.
And Texas is seeing closure of hospitals in rural areas because we did not expand Medicaid. That is hurting the state in lots of ways, lots of areas, particularly seeing how much rural area that Texas has, you know, so that's a price we're paying.
Well, right. And I think if you looked at the states that have expanded recently, it's a lot different than it used to be politically. In the early days of the expansion, in the book that we wrote, we covered really the first 4 years of the law, and there was a pretty sharp partisan divide. Blue states are really quick to expand, red states more hesitant. But over the years, especially since 2016 or so, the term Obamacare, which was sort of invented by a Republican pollster to kind of fracture public opinion around the law, which was pretty positive initially, has really given way to a more bipartisan politics. If you look at North Carolina, a state where opposition to Medicaid was pretty robust and the legislature basically said it was never going to happen, there were some interesting coalitions. You had local chambers of commerce and hospital associations getting together and really persuading and finding some champions among people who had been the most stalwart opponents of Medicaid expansion. And I think that that's been the case in other states as well. And I think even in Texas, what's interesting to me as an outsider, as a non-Texan, is that even some of the more recent Medicaid expansion bills, while they've not received any committee hearings, they have been co-sponsored by Republicans. What seems different in Texas is that Republican leadership has not necessarily gotten on board, and I think that the stakes for them are somewhat different. I think they, you know, perhaps don't want to set a precedent for kind of going down this route, but it's, I think Texas is certainly an outlier here. There are only 12 states that haven't expanded Medicaid yet, and Texas is the largest one of them in terms of population.
Yeah, well, Texas leadership is beholden to the big donors, and they don't want to expand Obamacare because it was connected to Obama. We're going to talk more about that when we come back. How has Obamacare been for you, listener? Has it impacted your life, positive, negatively? We want to hear. We're kind of looking back on Obamacare and the struggle to pass it. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act, joined by the author, Philip Rocco. He is associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, co-author of that book. So, Philip Rocco, when we talk about Obamacare, you know, it all it really did is an insurance program. It created insurance for some people. There was some Medicaid expansion for some states, and it had some regulatory reform, but it didn't really upend the American healthcare system like its opponents said, or destroy the Constitution. I mean, why do people get so worked up about insurance?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting when you look at the history of the Affordable Care Act is a lot of the core ideas in the law, including the idea of a private health insurance exchange, were things that Republicans proposed in the 1990s as an alternative to what was then called national health insurance, but is today referred to as a sort of Medicare for all style policy. So in terms of the policy content, you know, Medicaid expansion is leaving a lot of the decisions to the states. You've got health insurance exchanges. Those were set up, designed to be on a state level, a sort of decentralized reform. A lot of this stuff in the law, you know, on paper, doesn't look, you know, especially radical. And indeed, if you look at the sort of interest group coalition for the law, you know, it included insurers, it included providers, it included hospital associations. And so I think it really struck some of the people that we talked to for the book way back when in 2015 or so, asking them to reflect on their experience, were officials charged with implementing the law in federal agencies. And they were shocked. They were shocked at how much partisan kind of opposition there was to the ACA, in part because they thought of it as a pretty moderate reform. And I think the answer to why things got so entrenched and so divided early on is you have to remember that the ACA was going through the legislative process in 2009, and 2010 was a midterm election year. And it wasn't just any election year. It was the election year after which state legislatures were going to get the chance to redistrict themselves, right? And if you think in states like mine in Wisconsin, that led to pretty serious partisan gerrymanders in those states. So it was really, really important to have an issue that sort of crystallized Republican kind of antipathy towards the president and the president's party, and the biggest policy reform that had been put out by the Obama administration, the Affordable Care Act. And so, you know, the intervention to try to like use this issue as like the main sort of dividing line, and to you know, really try to put together a backlash campaign, it worked. And it worked, and it had this sort of effect, not just on kind of the electorate, but it brought a wave of Republican-controlled legislatures, and they were able to, you know, redistrict. So it was, I guess my point is, it's not necessarily the content of the law that was polarizing. It's the fact that 2010 was a really, really important election year.
Right.
And there was a lot on the line politically,
right,
not
politically,
just in that year, but
not,
for the rest
but
of the
But healthcare-wise, not so much. Let me go to a caller. The number is 833-877-8255. Let's go to Carl. Carl, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Thanks for this conversation. I'm on Obamacare, and this year my preferred provider changed to an application called Galileo Health, and it's run by United Healthcare. So anytime I have a problem, or when I started out with this app, I had to upload all my patient records, and I went through some period where I had to tell them what was what and what was going on with me. And they've really helped me. Sorry.
No, thank you, Carl.
So I like that. My parents are hardcore Republicans, and they've always criticized Obamacare and said that it was part of this socialist regime by the Democrats, and I never have understood that. Another thing they've all told me too, they said, well, you know, if you're on Medicare or Medicaid or Obamacare, those doctors aren't good doctors. Those are like the B and C grade doctors, you know? If you have and you pay for good health insurance, then you get the smart doctors, the A-plus doctors. And I don't know if there's any trick to that, but my health care has gotten better with Galileo Health and United Healthcare.
Awesome,
and
Carl.
I have a very low premium.
Carl, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate that. So, Philip Rocco, anything to the smart doctors aren't on Obamacare?
Yeah, well, look, I think that people in their everyday lives, people have problems with the healthcare they receive, right? It you pay too much at the pharmaceutical counter. You have a conversation with your doctor and you don't think it's particularly helpful. These are really common. It's really common to talk to people who don't like their healthcare for one reason or another. And I think, you know, in reality, the ACA, there's a lot of gaps in it too. So, you know, a lot of people who are living in places where there's not a lot of, say, competition between providers, that, and they want to get onto the exchange. I mean, premiums can be expensive, right? But I think the fact that you had this really sharp partisan intervention early on, it sort of was able to take advantage of the fact that there are these gaps and that the law took about 4 years to roll out. So the way that people formed their impressions about the law was not necessarily on the basis of what it did, but on the basis of these sort of partisan identities. And I think one of the things that's really interesting is that, and those trend lines are pretty stable in terms of partisan attitudes towards the ACA. The one thing that's really interesting is that there was a period of change where you saw some movement among independents and Republicans towards warmth, I guess you would say, towards the ACA. And that was when Republicans introduced measures in 2017 to repeal the law.
Right.
Prospect of it actually being repealed kind of brought the material stakes of the law into focus for a lot of people. And I think it's where the perspective, like the callers kind of comes up. It's like, what, you know, there's this big partisan debate about, you know, how we feel about maybe not the law, but the president's party who passed it. But the prospect of some of those benefits being taken away is very unpopular.
Let's go to another caller. The number is 833-877-8255. Salvador is on the line. Salvador, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. How you doing?
Okay, you're on the air.
All right. Basically, I'm both a consumer and a person that is being insured by Obamacare over the last 8 years, I believe, since it came in, and also an insurance agent that sells the product. So I have to say, for all the products that are available in the market, Obamacare is the best product for a consumer that can qualify. And if that's what it's supposed to do, that has delivered what it's supposed to do, it basically pays the bills. The medical bills reduces your cost, makes it available. A lot of people didn't have access to medical insurance because of persisting conditions or budgets or whatever. And the plans are working, are delivering what they are supposed to deliver. And any attempt by any politician to go against Obamacare is an attempt against the best interests of the people. There's no other way to put it around it. Okay, so, I mean, I tell everybody, you know, you want health care, yes, vote blue, can't go red, you know, because they're going to kill it.
All right, Salvador, thank you for that. So to that point, I want to play a clip of, this is Donald Trump talking about Obamacare. This is after he was elected 2016. He's addressing a conference of legislators talking about Obamacare.
Our legislative work starts with repealing and replacing Obamacare and saving families from the catastrophic rise in premiums and debilitating loss of choice and just about everything else. And remember this for this room in particular. Obamacare is a disaster. The Democrats are up and they're saying, oh, they're putting up signs like it's wonderful. It's a disaster. I actually talked with Paul and the group about just doing nothing for 2 years, and the Dems would come begging to do something, because 17 is going to be catastrophic price increases, Your deductibles are through the roof. You can't use it. You can't use it. And they would come to us, except we have one problem. We have to take care of the American people immediately. So we can't wait. But every time they tell you about Obamacare, we're taking them out of a big jam. Big jam. We're putting ourselves at risk to a certain extent because we're taking it off their platter. But I think, Congressman, I think we have no choice. I think we have no choice. We have to get it going. I'm serious. If we waited 2 years, it's going to explode like you've never seen an explosion. Nobody's going to be able to afford it. It's a disaster. And that's politically what we should do. But we don't want to do that. We want to get something done and get it done right.
And what happened? They did not repeal or replace Obamacare. 2017, Arizona Senator John McCain, stricken with brain cancer, went to the Senate floor and cast his decisive thumbs down. And that ended the attempts to repeal Obamacare. So what is Trump? What was he talking about? Did it actually become a disaster for Americans?
No, I think this is the really interesting aspect of that moment in time in 2017. So for the prior, 4 years, 5 years, as the law began to be implemented, Republicans pledged to repeal the law, and they took in a bunch of votes in the House to do it. It was really kind of symbolic, right? They didn't have a plan that would cover the same number of people, eliminate some of the problems that people have with the law, or the fact that they couldn't get coverage. They thought the coverage was too expensive. When they finally had to put pen to paper and write a real bill, and then people took a look at what it would do, it saw actually millions of people would lose coverage. And so it's not like they had a bill that matched the language, because what they were saying was, look, we're going to repeal and replace it, but we're also going to make things better. We're going to alleviate these conditions. And when the rubber met the road, they didn't have the votes to do that, not just because of John McCain, but also because they couldn't actually get together a coherent caucus. Even if McCain had voted yes to repeal, there would have been a conference committee, and it's probably the case that you wouldn't have been able to get Senate and House agreement on that either, because in reality the measures that they were proposing would have made things worse. And so I think you began to see at that point Republicans kind of back away, at least in the electoral arena, not necessarily in the litigation arena, not necessarily in the courts, but in the electoral arena, they began to back away from those claims. Now, when it comes to what would it have been like if Republicans had done nothing, I think one thing that's really interesting is that when Trump came in, his Department of Health and Human Services actually did kind of take positive steps in ways that made the insurance market worse. They let back in some kind of predatory
plans. These skinny plans. He had these executive orders that allowed, so that were not helpful. But we got to take a break. We got to take a break right here. But it does seem like, you know, Philip Rocco, that you're describing a typical Democratic trap that they set for Republicans, which is create good governance, good policies that help people. Republicans oppose that, but then they're unable to do anything about it. And in the end, will voters hold them accountable for opposing positive progressive legislation? So that's the question we're going to ask coming back. 833-877-8255. I have a caller, Edward, on the board. I'll get him on the air when we come back. 833-TPR-TALK. Repeal or replace Obamacare. What happened with that? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Support for this podcast comes from Big Sun Solar, committed to helping businesses strive towards energy independence and conservation. Solar is a great way for businesses to lower their carbon footprint. More at bigsunsolar.com/TPR.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a conversation with Philip Rocco. He is the co-author of the book Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act, taking a look at the fight to pass Obamacare, fight to keep it, and what happens next. Could this be a playbook for future progressive action in America? Or not. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And Edward is on the line. Edward, you're on the air, sir. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Thanks for the conversation, and especially that promise for future progressive action. I don't see the ACA as progressive at all. There were some wins marginally for some people. It's undeniable, but ultimately, it was a bill that upheld the massive corporate status quo and profitable industry. So I'd like to hear you and your guest, if you could get off of the Republican versus Democrat, diverge from that for a moment, and talk about why the Democrats controlled both houses of Congress and the presidency, did they not even attempt to get traction on a single-payer bill? They didn't even try.
Edward, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. So Philip Rocco, President Obama did get the major healthcare industry on board because he didn't challenge them. He didn't. He wasn't going to upend the industry. In fact, he was going to make them more profitable. Was that it?
And I think this is the really important point that the caller points out, is that if you look back at efforts to create what was called national health insurance, there was a sort of credible effort during even the Nixon administration. It was an agenda item for President Jimmy Carter. Never made it through the legislative process, but it was. And in the early 1990s, the concept of national health insurance or Medicare for All was one of the central ideas that was being debated when Democrats had that brief period of unified government in the early 1990s. When we get to 2009, that model of reform is not even on the table. And I think, you know, there's a couple reasons for that. I think one is that something really changed about the healthcare insurance industry between the early 1990s and the 2000s. One is that they really consolidated and their power increased through those consolidations. And they also made real inroads in politics, particularly within the Democratic Party. And so what kind of emerged at that point is the strategy of keeping AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plan, the sort of the big industry lobbying group, kind of in the tent as a strategy to pass the law. But the consequence, right, is that the major reason why healthcare costs continue to go up for Americans, this sort of fragmented approach where purchasers don't really have leverage over providers, that fragmented approach is really what keeps costs high and keep costs rising. What it means is that even though the uninsurance rate has gone down, the number of people who lack any coverage at all, 43% of Americans are still what is known as underinsured, meaning they spend more than 10% of their household income on out-of-pocket costs. They have deductibles that are more than 5% of their household income, or they are paying in a way too much for health insurance.
Right, but to the question of the caller, he says, okay, well, you know, this is what we ended up with, and it's not enough. We need universal health care coverage in the United States. Why can't we have that? And you wonder, like, wait, well, the lesson takeaway from the fight for Obamacare. Everyone was shouting and screaming and making up stuff and saying things. It was pretty loud. And it seems like the opposition went all in to fight Obamacare, which is basically, you know, like we said, it's about health insurance. It's about, you know, it's not universal health care. Why not fight for the whole kielbasa? Why not go in and fight for universal health care? If we know what they have, they showed us their hand, they went all in, and it was beaten. The Democrats were able to pass it.
Yeah, and I think this is the lesson, right, is that the political strategy that the Obama administration took in 2009 was, you know, how can we build a coalition for reform but not really mobilize too many people outside of the standard political process? If you're really sort of relying on a kind of standard inside the beltway strategy to pass a law, and you don't have the big industry players on side, you're going to lose. But that's not the only way of doing politics, right? If you look back at when Medicare was passed in 65, there was a huge kind of grassroots movement that had been germinating for years, kind of at the congressional district level, that made sure that you had supporters of creating a Medicare program for people over the age of 65 out at every single congressional event. There was pamphleteering. You had this kind of very coordinated movement. Now, of course, you had very different political margins in the House of Representatives and the Senate and all of that. But
you didn't have social media misinformation spreading like you have today.
There's that, too. But I think the other thing is that it was a different, I think, approach to politics that didn't rely on the, you know, kind of getting all of the most powerful interest group players on board. Think about, Billy Talzin, you know, after his role in kind of designing the pharmaceutical parts of the ACA. I mean, he went on and became like a huge lobbyist for pharma. And it's very clear what, you know, sort of why that was his gift, yeah, in return from giving them a gift.
All right, so I'm going to try and get to another caller. 833-877-8255. We have Carol, and Carol, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm so excited. Thank you. I Obamacare saved my life, and that's what I wanted to let everyone know. I'm a musician and a songwriter and a college graduate, but I've never made much money in my profession, so I've never been was able to afford health insurance. And when Obamacare was legalized, or I got it, and a month later I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I was living in Corpus Christi, near Corpus Christi, and I had excellent doctors. And I just wanted to say that several times. I had the best medical treatment, and most of it was covered by Obamacare. And they saved my life. And I've been 6 years out now, cancer-free, and I just can't say enough good things about Obamacare. I know that for people that made more money than I do, that I've heard them say their premiums were high. And but for me, it was a lifesaver.
Well, Carol, thank you so much, and congratulations on beating cancer, being cancer-free, and calling in. We appreciate your input. Philip Rocco, she was talking about, she alluded to this thing that was called the death spiral. There were predictions that there were going to be a death, that there weren't going to be enough healthy people signing up for Obamacare, and it was going to go into a death spiral. What happened?
Well, the reason why insurance markets go into a death spiral is people either don't want or can't afford the coverage in those markets, and so the people who the risk pool is covering are really, really costly, and you can't balance out the risk pool, and that's why you have a death spiral. Now, the thing that the ACA did that made that not happen was it offered a product people wanted to buy. And a lot of people wanted to buy. And I think that that's, you know, the argument that people make on behalf of the universal coverage is you're making the risk pool really big. So it's really much easier to balance out. It drives down those costs of coverage. But I think that it's kind of amazing. And I'm really happy that the caller shared that experience, because it is life changing. Right, being able to access healthcare and to have important procedures covered, it is life saving, and it's a really simple way of saving someone's life. A really simple way of improving somebody's life is making sure that when they're sick, they're not actually thinking about their pocketbook first. They're thinking about, you know, getting the care that they need.
Now, right now, President Biden is planning to expand Obamacare and Medicaid expansion for DACA Dreamers. And these are children who were brought into the country when they're illegally, and but you know now they're students and they have. So we know about Dreamers, but people are saying that this is a violation of the promise that was made during the campaign to pass Obamacare, that they said they would illegal immigrants would not qualify for it. So what's happening here?
Well, I mean, I think the concept here is to sort of use the same logic that's applied to Dreamers and other policy domains, which is to say that, you know, essentially, you know, we're making sure that when you're here, you have access to a lot of benefits that people who are born in the United States are eligible for. And I think the idea is like just applying that logic to this domain where it hadn't previously been applied by the government. And so, you know, I'm sure that it there's going to be political controversy in part because the immigration issue is so, you know, invites so much partisan rancor. But I mean, the reality is when you have a large number of people who make their home in the U.S., but they can't access health benefits, it is really, really bad for communities, really, really bad for health.
All right. So we're taking a break. We'll be right back in 1 minute. If you've got a question, a comment, want to tell us about your experience with Obamacare, were you on the front lines protesting for it, against it? Let us know. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the Obamacare Wars. It's a book co-written by our guest, Philip Rocco. Got a question, 833-877-8255. Philip, there's some other, you know, things happening right now. The Obamacare is never really out of the news. There is this current Texas federal judge ruling that strikes down part of Obamacare that says that insurance companies do not have to provide this free preventive care part of Obamacare. And that's now in the courts. This is something that people have credited for saving so many lives. It also includes PrEP, which stops the spread of HIV in the community, all sorts of things that this provision of Obamacare does. Yet right now it's on the chopping block. So what does this do? What are the stakes?
So it's really important to think about. The ACA didn't just expand access to purchasing health insurance or expand coverage through Medicaid. It also expanded the kinds of things that insurance plans could cover, right? So not just like who could be covered, like children or children up to the age of 26.
Yeah, we had that pre-existing insurance condition thing too.
Existing condition, right? But it also made sure that access to certain basic services like an annual physical, coverage of preventative coverage for things like HIV a bunch of other kind of preventative
colonoscopies
were covered in plans.
Like
colonoscopies, right? And the way that those treatments are authorized is that the U.S. there's a body called the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, which is a body within the federal government that recommends to the Department of Health and Human Services what insurers have to cover. Now, Reed O'Connor, who is a federal district court judge in Texas, who has been, over the last few years, he's been the go-to district judge when the sort of conservative legal movement wants to strike down some provision of Obamacare. They find a plaintiff who can file a case in that district. And so they just sort of single him out. And then what he can do is issue a nationwide injunction against that provision of the ACA. And the thing to note about O'Connor's rulings is that they tend to be overturned by higher courts, including a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, in part because the rulings are based on very sort of willfully negligent readings of the law and sometimes the Constitution. But the thing is, whereas in the kind of electoral realm, Republicans have sort of gone away from, to some extent, rolling back the ACA as such.
But I just want to underline how important this provision is and what's at stake. People should be paying attention to losing this preventive care element. Also, right now in Washington, D.C., as they're debating the debt ceiling, we're hearing from Speaker McCarthy that he wants to assign a work requirement for people who receive Medicaid. Does that work?
Well, I mean, I think this is the reality about work requirements in Medicaid is that we have evidence of what happens when you put that in. Under the Trump administration, they allowed states to experiment with Medicaid. Circuit court eventually struck that down, but one state, Arkansas, ended up putting those provisions into place. And what we saw is that it didn't necessarily increase anybody's incentive to work, because most of the people, three-fourths of the people who are on Medicaid and can work do. What it did was it threw 17,000 people off their Medicaid coverage in Arkansas. And the projection, and this is a pretty modest projection, it could be a lot higher, is that introducing work requirements in Medicaid on a national level would throw about 2 million people off their coverage. Because what work requirements are, and one reason why they don't necessarily induce more employment, part because a lot of people are already employed who can be, they're really just paperwork requirements. It's really just red tape. And it basically makes your benefits harder to access and easier for governments to throw you off and disenroll you. So I think the one thing that's interesting is that at a very generic level, I think Republicans are gaming out that these sort of things poll well. People think, you get a majority, but once you start telling people exactly what it is, the coalition for that electorally really shrinks down. So I'm not necessarily sure that this gambit is going to play out for Republicans politically in the way that they think it's going to, as a way of winning this sort of debt ceiling fight.
Right. Another caller. We have Christy on the line. Christy, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I am a nurse practitioner from San Antonio, Texas, and I was born and raised here. And my comment was in regards to people being concerned about DACA recipients or Dreamers getting benefits. But I think if you look at the bigger picture and people don't have preventative care, they're going to end up in the ER. And that's going to be much, much more expensive for everyone than it would be to provide affordable primary care or preventative care. And so it seems like if you look at the big picture, providing that would be a better route than people just denying it across the board.
Christy, thank you so much for your call. I do appreciate that. Very informative. I want to get back to this main point about, the Obamacare war, when we were having these civil discussions in the streets about our healthcare system in the United States and what to do about that. There were a lot of protests, and you have to wonder if they were manufactured, what people were saying, and we know this created the Tea Party movement and all sorts of other stuff, and it created a template that's still happening today with the spread of misinformation and fear-mongering. I want to play a clip. This is from people who are protesting a congressman trying to convince him, a Democratic congressman in New York City, convincing him to vote no in the Affordable Care Act.
It's important to support the effort to stop this unconstitutional takeover of America.
Well, I think it's important that we let the leadership of the Congress, in this case Bob Etheridge, know that we don't want what they're trying to put off on us. So we're out here letting them know. And the only way we can tell them.
Vote no, Bob Etheridge, vote no.
I think that health care is not their primary issue. I think their primary issue is the takeover of America and the destruction of America as a republic founded on the Constitution. And all our hollering won't do anything, I don't think. However, we have to do it. because I have to stand before God someday and tell him that I tried to stand up for what was right.
Philip Rocco, these were good people. They just were told a lot of bad information. Those talking points, fear of the expansion of federal power, the destruction of the Constitution, did that happen?
No, I mean, I think the reality is the one reason why these kinds of ideas, in a way, conspiracy theories about the ACA could circulate is I think that a lot of the debate, especially because there was this really long bleed-in period for the law, it was really not being had in terms of what the benefits of the law were, but only in terms of these kind of this kind of partisan rhetoric. And I think that as a result, it was possible to fill in any number of fears, concerns, worries about the power of government, because in reality, those symbols, those images in people's heads were really all that the material or the substance of politics had to deal with. And when in reality, when people are able to get benefits, they're able to get healthcare, and they see, lo and behold, that it constitutes an improvement to their lives, it's harder, I think, to hold some of those views.
Let's go to our caller. We have Keith on the line. Keith, you're on the air.
Hey there. I was just wanting to share an idea that my mom came up with a long time ago. And it was essentially, you know, the government prints out money. We all want and need that. And they're at the forefront of medical stuff for the most part, and military and whatnot, all these public or these human issues. Well, why don't they have like an encyclopedia or a volumes of encyclopedia, kind of like a phone book, but for your health, as far as, you know, you can look up things, reference, you know, be pragmatic and find your own, find out what's going on with your own ailments, because the internet can have a lot of too much or hard to understand information, and that's before you even get people's other opinions involved. So right. It's like a
Keith, thank you for that interesting idea. Philip Rocco, healthcare is complicated. People are looking for answers. It's not always easy to navigate. Did Obamacare make it harder for people to get healthcare?
No, I mean, it really, if you look just at the rates of service provision and insurance levels, I mean, it improved the access to healthcare kind of across the board. Certainly, finding information about you know, evidence-based medicine can be difficult. I think one of the interesting things is that actually part of the ACA was kind of improving access to evidence-based medicine, and I think did create some data sharing provisions and information sharing provisions. But I think one of the bigger challenges is that it didn't, you know, there are still gaps in coverage, and people might not
get still work to be done.
The care that they need. There's still a lot of work to be done. That's right.
All right. Philip Rocco, PhD, co-author of Obamacare Wars, Federalism, State Politics, and the Affordable Care Act, associate professor, Department of Political Science at Marquette University. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been fun talking to you.
All right. Likewise, David. Take care.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies, with production support from Kayla Padilla and Mark Hutchison. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. Support for The Source comes from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.